that exist in society and prejudices. But when it comes to issues of Palestine, it's as though they are blindsided, and they very much become extensions of the policing arm of the state. Schools and school leaders have a duty to foster an environment within their schools that is conducive to civic education and to create students which are active citizens in the future. What schools should not be doing is disciplining students for practicing basic empathy and showing solidarity with oppressed people around the globe.
For adult activists, speaking up for Palestine could see your reputation assassinated. But now, even young, aspiring humanitarians could see their futures dashed simply for speaking out. Robert Carter, London.
Following an easing of restrictions in the EU and UK, coronavirus cases across Western Europe are on a sharp upward curve. The Delta variant, first identified in India and which spreads much more easily, is being blamed.
The world is becoming a village, so people travel, it's hard to contain.
See all the people here, and some people are not that careful, I think, so...
One word for me, go to vaccine.
The vast majority of young adults and children in the EU have not been vaccinated. This is why the virus is moving around so quickly, experts say.
In view of the rapid spread of the highly contagious Delta variant that is raising concerns not only in Europe but also around the globe, it is extremely important to vaccinate, as per national recommendations, as many people in Europe as possible.
Economists say the EU simply cannot afford further lockdowns. Economic forecasts for the 27-nation bloc are positive, but there are a lot of unknowns.
We continue to monitor the situation very closely. And in particular, and obviously, we are monitoring the Delta variant.
The fact that protectionist Donald Trump is no longer in the White House offers some economic hope, senior EU officials are indicating.
In terms of our relationships with the US, we have gone from a winter of discontents to a summer of cooperation.
In several EU nations, including Greece, France and Ireland, young people have staged protests believing they are being forced by governments to take the jab in order to participate in society. We have been getting some views in Belgium.
I mean, it's good that the protest is there, isn't it?
I feel forced to receive something I don't want to receive.
Be vaccinated or not, so you can't force people to do that.
Health authorities in the EU argue it is important that young people do get vaccinated, claiming they may only develop a mild illness initially with COVID-19, but could ultimately go on to suffer from long COVID, which can have life-changing implications. Campaigners say EU leaders are shooting themselves in the foot by not providing more vaccines to less well-off parts of the world. This could lead to new variants that might be resistant to existing vaccines, they warn. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As angry mobs block roads and clash with the army, the price of the dollar against the Lebanese lira was skyrocketing, hinting a gloomy outlook in the horizon. In an interview Thursday night, Hariri blamed President Aoun for impeding the cabinet formation process and for his resignation.
The group led by the president has decided not to cooperate with Saad Hariri, and all the obstacles that I have faced are because of that group. I did not want to just negotiate while knowing that I cannot form a cabinet, so I resigned because it seemed to me that President Aoun does not want to form a cabinet.
Presidential office slammed Hariri for his comments, declaring that Hariri was, quote, not ready to discuss amendments of any kind and closed the door on any talks. Experts see that Hariri is now launching an internal conflict, using resistance as a scapegoat.
It was obvious that he is preparing for his election campaign, because later in his interview yesterday night, he launched his election campaign by opening fire on the resistance in Lebanon.
Observers see that talk of electoral campaigns will be the main focus in the post-Hariri resignation era.
The Americans, they haven't reached a point to let the solution take place. They are still using the financial crisis as a blackmailing means to blackmail, to try to blackmail the resistance in Lebanon.
The state of despair on the streets of Beirut is a reflection of the general situation.
Everyone knew there would not be a new cabinet. The country has collapsed. If the prime minister wanted to actually form a cabinet, he would go for real negotiations. The result will be death of the people, no electricity, no water, and no fuel. Lebanon has fallen.
All the people need to protest. The rich and the poor are equal now, and all six are facing the same crisis.
They all want a piece of cheese for themselves. If they cannot rule right, they should leave. People are helpless. Hunger knows no religion or sect.
With the socio-economic crisis quickly escalating, many believe the end result will be a probable demise of the entire political system.
French sources described Hariri's move as cynical self-destruction for the political class. Others considered it the start of an electoral campaign. But one thing all sides agree on is that it puts Lebanon in the face of a chaotic period ahead. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In the limelight.
U.S. policy has perpetuated the crisis and atrocities of the Zionist regime occupation by unconditionally supporting the regime of Israel in three distinct ways, militarily, diplomatically, and politically. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Miria Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis Writers. This article is published under the heading, How the United States Helps to Kill Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The U.S. corporate media usually report on the Israeli regime military assaults in occupied Palestine as if the United States is an innocent, neutral party to the conflict. In fact, large majorities of Americans have told pollsters for decades that they want the United States to be neutral in Israeli regime atrocities. But U.S. media and politicians betray their own lack of neutrality by blaming Palestinians for nearly all the violence and framing flagrantly disproportionate, indiscriminate, and therefore illegal Israeli attacks as a justifiable response to Palestinian actions. The classic formulation from U.S. officials and commentators is that Israel has a right to defend itself. Never Palestinians have the right to defend themselves, even as the Israelis massacre hundreds of Palestinian civilians, destroy thousands of Palestinian homes, and seize ever more Palestinian land. The disparity in casualties in Israeli regime assaults on Gaza speaks for itself. At the time of writing this article, the current Israeli regime assault on Gaza has killed at least 200 people, including 59 children and 35 women. In the 2008 to 2009 assault on Gaza, the Zionist regime killed 1,417 Palestinians, while their meager efforts to defend themselves killed 9 Israelis. In 2014, 2,251 Palestinians and 72 Israelis, mostly soldiers invading Gaza, were killed as U.S.-built F-16s dropped at least 5,000 bombs and missiles on Gaza, and Israeli tanks and artillery fired 49,500 shells, mostly massive 6-inch shells from U.S.-built M-109 howitzers. In response to largely peaceful March of Return protests at the Israel-Gaza border in 2018, Israeli regime snipers killed 183 Palestinians and wounded over 6,100, including 122 that required amputations, 21 paralyzed by spinal cord injuries, and 9 permanently blinded. As with the Saudi-led war on Yemen and other serious foreign policy problems, bias and distorted news coverage by U.S. corporate media leaves many Americans not knowing what to think. Many simply give up trying to sort out the rights and wrongs of what is happening and instead blame both sides and then focus their attention closer to home, where the problems of society impact them more directly and are easier to understand and do something about. So how should Americans respond to horrific images of bleeding, dying children and homes reduced to rubble in Gaza? The tragic relevance of this crisis for Americans is that behind the fog of war, propaganda and commercialized biased media coverage, the United States bears an overwhelming share of responsibility for the carnage taking place in Palestine. U.S. policy has perpetuated the crisis and atrocities of the Zionist regime occupation by unconditionally supporting the regime of Israel in three distinct ways, militarily, diplomatically, and politically. On the military front, the United States has so far provided $146 billion in foreign aid, nearly all of it military-related. It currently provides $3.8 billion per year in military aid to the Zionist regime. In addition, the United States is the largest seller of weapons to the Israeli regime, whose military arsenal now includes 362 U.S.-built F-16 warplanes and 100 other U.S. military aircraft, including a growing fleet of the new F-35s, at least 45 Apache attack helicopters, 600 M109 howitzers, and 64 M270 rocket launchers. At this very moment, the Zionist regime is using many of these U.S.-supplied weapons in its devastating bombardment of Gaza. The U.S. military alliance with the Zionist regime also involves joint military exercises and joint production of Arrow missiles and other weapon systems. The U.S. and Israeli regime militaries have collaborated on drone technologies tested by the Israelis in Gaza. The U.S. military also maintains a $108 billion stockpile of weapons at 6 locations in occupied Palestine, pre-positioned for use in future U.S. wars in the West Asia region. During the Zionist regime assault on Gaza in 2014, even as the U.S. Congress suspended some weapons deliveries to Israel, it approved handing over stocks of 120mm mortar shells and 40mm grenade launcher ammunition from the U.S. stockpile for the Zionist regime to use against Palestinians in Gaza. Diplomatically, the United States has exercised its veto in the UN Security Council 82 times, and 44 of those vetoes have been to shield the Zionist regime from accountability for war crimes or human rights violations. In every single case, the United States has been the lone vote against the resolution, although a few other countries have occasionally abstained. It is only the United States' privileged position as a veto-wielding permanent member of the Security Council and its willingness to abuse that privilege to shield its ally, the Zionist regime, that gives it this unique power to stymie international efforts to hold the regime of Israel accountable for its actions under international law. The result of this unconditional U.S. diplomatic shielding of the Zionist regime has been to encourage increasingly barbaric Israeli treatment of the Palestinians. With the United States blocking any accountability in the Security Council, the Zionist regime has seized ever more Palestinian land in the West Bank and East Al-Quds uprooted more and more Palestinians from their homes and responded to the resistance of largely unarmed people with ever-increasing violence, detentions, and restrictions on day-to-day life. Thirdly, on the political front, AIPAC and other pro-Israel lobbying groups have exercised an extraordinary role in bribing and intimidating U.S. politicians to provide unconditional support for the Israeli regime. The roles of campaign contributors and lobbyists in the corrupt U.S. political system make the U.S. uniquely vulnerable to this kind of influence, peddling, and intimidation, whether it is by monopolistic corporations and industry groups like the military-industrial complex and Big Pharma, or well-funded interest groups like the NRA, AIPAC, and in recent years, lobbies for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. President Joe Biden, who has a long history of supporting Israeli regime crimes, responded to the latest massacre by insisting on Israel's right to defend itself and inanely hoping that this will be closing down sooner than later. His UN ambassador also shamefully blocked a call for a ceasefire at the UN Security Council. The silence and words from President Biden and most of representatives in Congress at the massacre of civilians and mass destruction of Gaza is unconscionable. The United States has played a vital and instrumental role in the decades-long catastrophe that has engulfed the people of Palestine.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Spotlight.
Washington has accused Beijing of hacking Microsoft. This time, the U.S. is not alone in blaming China. The Biden administration has organized a number of allies to condemn Beijing for cyber attacks around the world. China has responded by blaming the U.S. for global eavesdropping. Now, Beijing saying it's a major victim of cyber attacks. It alludes to tens of thousands of overseas malware servers, many of them in NATO countries, attacking millions of Chinese computer hosts. Now, what's the goal of this digital software that the West has launched against China? How far could it go, and what would that entail?
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the U.S. and some of its Western allies, including the U.K., have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming it as, quote, fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China,
on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept. For years, the US and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the US administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy 2 warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the U.S. and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of 7 wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington see as a threat to its global hegemony.
All right, that was a report by Mehdi Farman. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najafi, and we're discussing the blame game that the West has waged against China. Joining me in tonight's show will be author and journalist Daniel Lazar in New York. From the Asia Desk at the Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Dillington in Leesburg, Virginia. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's start with Daniel. The U.S. is accusing China of cyber attacks, and China is responding by accusing the U.S. of indiscriminate eavesdropping across the world. So what's going on?
Well, it seems that the U.S. is ramping up its campaign against China. This campaign is growing more and more intense under the Biden administration. Whose whole raison d'etre, whose whole reason for existence is to essentially restore U.S. hegemony around the globe after the setbacks, what Democrats see as the setbacks, during the Trump years. So that means stepped up pressure on Russia and stepped up pressure on China as well. And certainly the latest allegations about cyber attacks is part of that campaign. The Europeans echoed the charges that China has allowed its territory to be used for cyber attacks. The Europeans did not intentionally separated themselves from U.S. allegations that the Chinese intelligence agencies are behind the attacks. The U.S. has offered no evidence for that. The charges are highly explosive, if they were true. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. credibility, which has suffered tremendously over the last 20 years, takes another blow when the U.S. makes unwarranted, unsubstantiated allegations like this. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. is on the warpath. It's trying to push China back. China is refusing to budge. And some kind of significant confrontation seems to be taking place between the U.S. and China. We don't know what form that confrontation will take, but there's every reason to think that the confrontation is intensifying, that it'll reach some kind of climax in the coming period, and that it's extremely dangerous, not only for the two countries involved, the U.S. and China, but for the globe in general. We do not want a conflict, a military conflict between the U.S. and China, two nuclear powers with immense military capabilities.
Now, Mike, American officials say that this diplomatic goal behind this concerted move is to make China and Russia agree to a set of guardrails for behavior, maybe an accord on what targets and behavior would be prohibited. Is that really the main goal?
Rules-based order, right? The rules-based order that you hear all the time from the British and the U.S. is simply a phrase which says, we do not follow international law anymore. We set the rules, and you must follow our rules. Remember, there are international laws. They were established by the UN after the war. All of those laws demonstrate quite clearly that every one of the U.S. and British regime change invasions was a wild violation of international law, whereas Russia and China have done no such thing. But I want to make one correction to your initial statement, and I understand why, because it's always conveyed this way in the media. But this was not initiated by the U.S. Typically, this was initiated by the British, and they dragged the U.S. along to do their bidding on their view that the British are the brains with the dumb giant America doing their bidding for colonial wars and so forth, as in Iraq and Libya and Syria. And it's the same thing here. This was, in this case, the British even acknowledged that they were the author. The GCHQ, which is the center of their intelligence, the NSA equivalent, put out a statement today with the National Cybersecurity Center, which is part of that institution, which just read straight out, quote, the UK has revealed that Chinese state-backed actors were responsible for gaining access to computer networks around the world via Microsoft Exchange servers. And they go on to say that this is the most significant widespread cyber and so on and so forth. But as usual, like with Tony Blair saying it is very likely that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, this statement is full of almost certain, highly likely, or even just likely. And as Mr. Lazar said, Joseph Borrell from the EU did not say that this was Chinese state supported. They say these are people who may have been in China. But the British and the dumb giant in the United States is going along with that. The second thing I'd correct is that you cannot look at the U.S. as a single voice, even with the Biden administration. I'm sure you remember that under Trump, he talked about being friends with Russia, friends with China, ending the regime change wars, and none of that happened because the military-industrial complex has a greater power and Wall Street over than the presidency. And that's still true. You cannot ignore the fact that Biden, despite what Tony Blinken and the State Department are saying, had a meeting with Vladimir Putin, had an almost four-hour phone call with Vladimir Putin. And on this case as well, he said, we don't think this was the Chinese state, but we think it was Chinese actors. So the whole thing is hokum, as usual, like most highly likely and so forth. And it is very dangerous. There's no question about that. But I think we have to think in terms of how to get around this insanity and to bring about a higher ordered agreement. And I will go on in the next segment if you wish, but what's happening in Afghanistan indicates precisely the location of where we can, in fact, bring Russia and China and the United States together. And I'd be glad to discuss that.
Okay. Now, Daniel, no sanctions were announced against China on Monday. That's in sharp contrast to what the penalties of Washington imposed on Moscow in April over solar wind attacks that allegedly affected U.S. government agencies and 100 firms. Why no sanctions or penalties this time?
Well, the U.S. is highly dependent on China at this point. I mean, China holds large amounts of U.S. Treasury securities, and if they were to dump those, if they got sufficiently angry at Washington and dumped those securities, the result would be economic turmoil. China is also a major supplier of manufactured goods for the U.S., and the U.S. really can't afford to have an open trade war, so therefore it's treading somewhat lightly. And I also think it's very possible that the Biden administration doesn't really have full confidence in these findings. The idea that it's the Chinese intelligence agencies which are behind these attacks, I mean, that's a real stretch. And to impose sanctions on on the basis of that assertion alone, which could have dramatic economic consequences, is maybe just a step too far for the Biden administration. So this is all to the good that the administration is treading somewhat cautiously, but nonetheless, they're pushing, or they are being pushed by forces behind the scenes. And there's no doubt that some kind of confrontation is brewing, and that is extremely dangerous.
Okay. And Mike, you know, as U.S. is pushing this, China is responding by saying that it was the U.S. that engaged in large-scale, organized, and indiscriminate cyber intrusion, and citing the 2013 revelations by Edward Snowden that set off a debate about government surveillance. Let's have your take on that.
It wasn't a debate. It was an exposure of the fact that the U.S. is basically a police state and surveils everybody in the world. So that's known. That's not a surprise. The Chinese are absolutely right. But look, it's very important to look what's just happened in Afghanistan. You know, the U.S. pulled out rather precipitously, and there's many, many people saying, oh, this could be a disaster. You could have a return of terrorism and drugs. But the U.S. attended a meeting in Uzbekistan this last week. Khalilzad was there, and the advisor to Biden on Homeland Security, Elizabeth Sherwood Randall, was also there, and signed an agreement with Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Uzbekistan, which explicitly said that we want to back the building of infrastructure and transit, building transit links, which is the program being pursued by the Chinese and the Russians for the last 10 years, to make Afghanistan once again the hub for the new Silk Road, for the Belt and Road program, rather than the graveyard of empires, as it's been known since the British-Russian Great Game. And this is very, very serious. It may not work. I'm not being Pollyanna about this, but the fact that the U.S. government itself said that China could play a very positive role in the rebuilding of Afghanistan, and that at least officially we're signing documents which the SCO, as well as this special grouping that was meeting in Tashkent this last week, are committed to dealing with this pullout by the U.S. as an opportunity. And of course, you know, the U.S. is there for 20 years. We obviously failed miserably. We achieved nothing except horror and chaos and massive drug production. So good, they're out. But you don't want them to get out in a way which turns into another, you know, uncontrolled terror drug output. Remember, Afghanistan produces 80% of the world's opium.
Right.
So now we have the potential of the U.S. and Joe Biden, who, despite all of his horrible problems and his early stage dementia, is an old-style Democrat who obviously believes that there should be face-to-face diplomacy with Vladimir Putin, which he's carried out, and which he has hinted, and people around him whom we're in touch with indicate that he also wants such an agreement with Xi Jinping. This is absolutely crucial to get Russia and China and the U.S. to sit down together and to override, basically, the British and the U.S. intelligence circles, the Wall Street crowd, and the military-industrial complex. Is that a big ticket? That's a huge ticket. Is it possible? It's possible precisely because we're watching the greatest breakdown of civilization in modern history, the breakdown of the financial system, which is now completely out of control and going into hyperinflation, the threat of a nuclear war, this Green New Deal insanity, which is trying to shut down industrial development and impose virtual genocide in the third world. And there is a flashback to this. People are beginning to react against the insanity of a world gone nuts and want to see a higher order principle based on peace through development, okay, the message that Lyndon LaRouche has been arguing for the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, let's look at Europe. Europe has lucrative business with China, as you know, and has been unwilling to criticize the country in the past, but this time it's done that, and it's done that publicly, of course, without mentioning directly China. Is this a change of heart or what?
Well, I think Europe is trying to straddle the difference. I mean, Europe doesn't want a war, obviously, with the exception of Boris Johnson's Britain. It wants to tread very carefully. It wants to do business. It wants to maintain international comity and good relations. So the Europeans' response to this latest U.S. Move was very careful. They they backed the U.S. when it came to charges that these attacks are emanating out of China, but they refused to go along with the Biden administration's accusation that Chinese state intelligence agencies are involved. And that's a very important distinction. So they want to maintain the integrity of the internet. They want to stop criminal abuses of this sort. But they don't want to engage in this kind of global imperialist madness that the U.S. Is pushing. And I think that as I said before, I mean, Biden's whole raison d'etre is to restore the global hegemony that the U.S. exercised prior to Trump, but he can't do it. The U.S. is losing power dramatically. Its defeat in Afghanistan is the most dramatic example recently. But the U.S. is grossly overextended. Its empire lacks a rationale. There's no rational basis for it. But yet the Biden administration is pushing in order to restore the status quo ante. And this is very dangerous because it won't be able to do so. And the danger is that it will overreach and blunder into some kind of military confrontation. And the U.S. has a lengthy example of these kinds of reckless, careless actions, and the chances are very high it'll do this. It's doing the same thing again in the South China Sea and other conflict zones.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, China featured prominently in the G7 communique that was held recently. The group of seven wealthy nations are planning to set up an infrastructure to compete with China's massive Belt and Road Initiative. So what would that mean for the global economy?
Well, I wish they would compete with the Belt and Road by starting to invest in infrastructure around the world, which the U.S. has not done for about 35 or 40 years now. Mm-hmm. That's not what they meant by that. This was an effort to stop the Belt and Road by declaring the Belt and Road to be an imperialist trick. They're trying to take over the world. They are diplomatically threatening countries like El Salvador, like Argentina, like African countries, threatening them that if they do proceed with accepting Chinese investments in infrastructure and development, which is the one hope they have of getting out of poverty and becoming modern nations, and they're being threatened that if they proceed with this, they're going to be punished with sanctions, with cutoff of credit, and so forth. Let me make one important point again.
Sure.
David's right that Biden has, by and large, gone along with what the military-industrial complex says, as Trump ended up doing as well. But it's important that he, like I said, he is distinguishing himself from the Tony Blinkens, who's just another Mike Pompeo, by having these meetings with Russia and potentially with China. And on this issue, he, like the EU, said, our intelligence says that this was done in China, but there's no indication that this was done by the Chinese government. Mm-hmm. And this is, it might seem small, but this is important. And with this going on in Afghanistan, the potential over these next days for some significant coming together around a reconstruction program for Afghanistan, this is not only important for Central Asia, this is important for the world. The Iraqis are looking at this very, very closely. The Syrians are looking at this as a basis for saying, let's get the U.S. troops out and let's bring in the Belt and Road and development. And there's a hint, at least, a hint that the U.S. could go along with that, which would be a real phase change, which is what my organization is fighting to make happen here by bringing into play these international forces who are trying to bring about a sane resolution to this global breakdown crisis.
Okay, we have only 1 minute left, Daniel. The more sanctions and pressure the U.S. is piling under different pretexts, the closer China and Russia are getting together, they're approaching countries for cooperation. Let's have your comment.
Well, I think what's happening is the more the U.S. efforts in this regard are counterproductive. The more it pushes, the more it only succeeds in uniting a variety of countries against its own power grab. So China, Russia, Japan, China, Russia, and Iran are the best examples of this. They are being forced. They're highly disparate countries. They believe different things. They have different backgrounds. But they are being forced into a union because due to opposition to the lawless behavior by the United States, the lawless bullying behavior by the United States. And the more the United States pushes in this regard, the more Russia, China, and Iran are forced to cooperate and to form an alliance against these aggressive moves emanating out of Washington.
Okay, got to jump in. We're out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. Author and journalist Daniel Lazar in New York, and from the Asia Desk of the Executive Intelligence Review, we had Mike Billington from Leesburg, Virginia. And that's it for this edition of The Spotlight. I've been your host, Andrew Snyder.
In the limelight. Brioni Worthington, founder and board member of the new not-for-profit Climate Action Group, said, "By sharing and channeling data, we can maximize our efforts to combat carbon emissions and global warming. In other words, data is going to be the new water." We'll prepare for you an article written by Robin McKee. The piece is titled, "How Data Could Save Earth from Climate Change." SUBEC may seem an odd choice for a new organization that aims to accelerate high-tech efforts to combat climate crisis. The name is Indonesian, it transpires, and refers to an ancient agricultural system that allows farmers to coordinate their efforts when irrigating and growing crops. Brioni Worthington, founder and board member of the new not-for-profit Climate Action Group, said, "SUBEC allows farmers to carefully synchronize their use of water and so maximize rice production." She added, "And that is exactly what we're going to do with data. By sharing and channeling data, we can maximize our efforts to combat carbon emissions and global warming. In other words, data is going to be the new water." SUBEC will be officially launched in the coming days and will select and fund non-profit groups working around the world to combat the climate crisis. Early startups already helped by SUBEC include one group that is assisting UK local authorities to boost electric car use, while another group is using accurate weather forecasts to make best use of solar power across Britain and limit fossil fuel burning to generate electricity. These efforts are being launched after a week of headlines that have highlighted how perilous life on Earth is becoming as global heating grips the planet. Floods in Germany and Belgium left more than 150 people dead. Scientists revealed that the Brazilian rail forest now emits more carbon dioxide than it absorbs. And wildfires devastated vast tracts of Californian forests. In each case, scientists warned that rising temperatures triggered by increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are likely to have played a key role in bringing about these catastrophes. Brioni Worthington, a noted climate activist and lead author of the team which drafted the UK's 2008 Climate Change Act, legislation that required the UK to reduce its carbon emissions by at least 80% of their 1990 levels, says urgent action is clearly needed. At the time, Worthington was working with Friends of the Earth, but was seconded to government to help design the legislation. For her efforts, she was made a peer in 2010. Since then, Brioni Worthington has continued in the battle against the climate crisis, and in 2019 she read Harvard academic Shoshana Zuboff's book The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which focuses, disapprovingly, on high-tech companies' growing use of personal data to make money. Brioni Worthington says, "It woke me up to the fact that a whole new world of digital tools was being deployed to generate profits." She added, "I realized it would be better if those tools could be used to save the planet, to protect the global commons, and not merely to boost share value." Worthington contacted G. Fernando, a technology entrepreneur, and the pair hatched the idea of SUBAC, which has since been given funding by the Quadrature Climate Foundation, QCF, that was recently set up by the London investment management company Quadrature Capital. Its aim is to provide initial funding to help groups establish themselves, but also to give expert guidance over legal management and other issues. G. Fernando says, "When you start up a company or group, you are quite alone," adding, "So if you have a community around you that can offer help, human resources, finance, tools, that is incredibly helpful. And then, once the group gets on their feet, they can then start to help other startup entrepreneurs wanting to open new avenues in order to help fight climate change." Fernando's words are echoed by several of the groups that SUBAC has already helped to set up, such as Open Climate Fix. This aim to reduce carbon emissions by improving weather forecasts to make the best use of solar power plants, whose effectiveness is reduced when the weather is cloudy. Open Climate Fix's co-founder Jack Kelly said, "If we get very good data about forthcoming cloud cover, we will know exactly how much solar-generated electricity can be provided in the United Kingdom on a given day." Adding, "That will mean we will not need to generate unnecessary electricity from other sources, in particular fossil fuel sources, such as gas, because we have underestimated the solar power we will get that day. That will help to reduce carbon emissions." Jack Kelly added, "SUBAC's provision of engineers and software experts who have turned weather satellite images into cloud cover forecasts was a critical piece of assistance." A similar tale is told by Richard Allen of New Automotive, which is monitoring new electric cars are being taken up in communities across the United Kingdom. Factors include vehicle use, sales patterns, and favorite types of cars and trucks. That data can be fed to local authorities to ensure charging stations, battery replacement services, and other resources are provided to maximize take-up of electric cars. Richard Allen says, "Replacing petrol and diesel vehicles with electric versions as quickly as possible is going to be extremely important in reducing carbon emissions." He adds, "And data about take-up rates in communities will be vital in achieving that goal." This view is endorsed by Brioni Worthington. She says, just a major corporation has lots of different companies under its control. Subak is going to help set up lots of new outfits, each aimed at boosting efforts to control climate change. Climate crisis in numbers, 415. The number of parts per million of carbon dioxide that make up the atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution in the mid-1700s, the global average amount of carbon dioxide was about 280 parts per million. Burning fossil fuels has since added a further 135 parts per million, and if global energy demand continues to grow and is met mostly with fossil fuels, that figure could exceed 900 parts per million by 2100. 3.6 millimeter, the estimated increase each year in sea level, according to measurements of tide gauges and satellite data. This is a result of human-induced warming of the planet. It is projected that the sea level will rise a further 40 to 80 centimeters by 2100, although future ice sheets melt could make these values considerably higher. 43.1 billion. In 2019, that was the number of tons of carbon dioxide from human activities that were emitted into the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas that absorbs heat and releases it gradually over time, like bricks in a fireplace after the fire goes out. Current increases in greenhouse gases has tipped the Earth's energy budget out of balance, trapping additional heat and raising Earth's average temperature. 28 trillion, the estimated number of tons of ice that our planet has lost between 1994 and 2017. Global warming has a particularly severe impact at higher latitudes, and this has been most noticeable in the Arctic region. Scientists worry that as ice melts, less solar radiation will be reflected back into space, and temperatures will rise even faster. Ice loss will become increasingly severe as a result.